Good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
everybody. We are here gathered on the face of the earth, underneath the sky. The sun is making its path across the sky. That's going to be important, mostly tomorrow. But it's good to be here. So, today we're talking about the borderlands. And it's important when we talk about anything to position ourselves so that it's clear who we are and how we're using material, because if we act like there's no implications of what we're using and how we're using it, then we lose all meaning and it becomes entirely inflammatory. I am a Mexican-American person. My family comes from El Paso, Texas. It is the borderlands. My grandfather was born on a street which ends with what is now a wall. And this is the environment that I come out of. My family currently is multiracial, interreligious, queer, and multilingual. So I represent a way of looking at the world that recognizes what was here before and where we are now. And I'm always saying, what can we do more in terms of our both our lens and our actions and our words and our language? And there's always a trouble when we talk about history, because as they say, that the winners write the stories, and that's partly true, but it's also how the winners write the story and in what language and what sort of technology do you have to read or hear these stories. So there's a lot going on when we think about history. And there's power in the production of history, because it's not just what you say about who. Once again, it's how you say it and what is left out. And so what is signified by what you've said. So an example is when we talk about savages, you have signified the civilized. The savages are not the civilized, and to talk about savages puts you at some distance from them. So there is power in the production of history and making these labels. So there's things that are happening, different processes. And of course, I've already mentioned some of this. Power involves what is produced, who is published, where it is sent, how it is sold, how it is marketed, where you can read it or hear it. And so keep in mind power and the production of history as we go forward. So I have a question for you all. What does the borderlands mean to you? Let's get, say, two or three.
Are there wrong answers?
That is the wrong question. What does the borderlands mean to you?
Interfaces.
Interfaces.
On the edge.
On the edge.
Frontiers.
The frontier.
Transitions.
Transitions. So, a point of liminality where things change, where things transform. Spaces in flux, even, where things redefine.
Artificial boundaries.
Artificial boundaries. Okay.
Or dividing lines.
Dividing lines.
Barriers.
Barriers.
No man's land.
No man's land. And while we're talking about this in your words, the idea of a border has space around it, right? And if you travel to some places, you will find that, especially where people speak different languages on either side of this line, people very close to that line often speak both languages, or even speak a third language. And you'll see this especially in places with a lot of boundaries and borders. There's a third or fourth or sixth culture happening in the space around a border. Okay. What is the residue of history?
Dispossession.
Dispossession.
Unresolved issues.
Unresolved issues. What's that?
Hate.
Hate? Okay.
Can there be positive residues?
Of course.
Like music, okay. Cultures that are...
Music and culture?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a result of decisions made in the past.
Aha. Okay.
And And choices made in the past.
Absolutely. So things left over, things that continue into the present. Okay. Very good. So specifically when I'm talking about borderlands, part of what I'm talking about is something historically, a geopolitical area of the world called the Spanish-American borderlands. And we're going to talk about that first. And that is the outposts, the frontier of New Spain in the New World. And this was an area that was constantly contested, it was constantly changing, and of course there were people that were there before the Spanish made it New Spain. And it was a space where culture developed, things happened. But part of the point of this borderlands is it was a space in between New Spain and New France and New England and eventually the United States of America. So this was a space that Spain thought of as a barrier between these other European empires and its empire. And this is left out of most of our history. And so one of my goals today is to talk about this, to shine some light on some of the history that has left a residue on our land and our language and our culture. The other area of the borderlands is, of course, the very literal space around the borders of this country and the different things that happen and the people that emerge in these spaces. And in one case, for example, if you are a Mexican-American, as I am, you grow up in a Spanish-speaking household in an English community or vice versa. And so, who are you? You are both or none or all. So borderlands culture is perhaps a third space. But most importantly for me, borderlands is a framework. It's a way to think about our society, our culture, our history, and who we are. So rather than it being a this is this and that is that and there's the line, it's the borderlands encompasses all of that because things are changing and people are moving and people are learning and exchanging recipes and flavors and styles. People are getting married, converting their religion, evolving on their attitudes towards people that are different than them. Right? So the borderlands for me is a way to think about things. And that is probably the thing I most want you to take away. By the residue of history, I'm talking about what is left over. And you can see this in the place names on our maps. We will get to that in a minute. You can see it in the architecture. You can see it in the food and the culture and the music and even in the religion. These are things that were there, perhaps most prominently, and now they're not so prominent, but they remain part of our culture. The New World, we call it the United States of America generally, or just America if we're being brief. This is a story of encounters and collisions and conflict and collaboration. It is not just a story of Europeans coming over and killing everyone and taking everything and making the world in their image. They worked at that very hard, but to say that this is the whole story pretends that the people that were there had no agency and had no life and had no ideas. And that's not true. A lot of our words come from indigenous languages. Any word in English that starts with A-L actually probably dates back to Arabic due to the Muslim takeover of Spain and the Iberian Peninsula, which I'm not going to talk too much about, but it's very interesting. So this is a point of contention. And tension and struggle, right? And we think of this, as I say, the New World. But it was already diverse. It wasn't like all the indigenous people, the Native Americans, were all the same. They had many differences in language and culture and religion and norms. They didn't always get along. And so before it was America, it was still already diverse. So this idea of the melting pot, or that we are suddenly faced with a changing, diversifying society, yes, in some areas, like a neighborhood, you can change the people that are in a neighborhood. But the idea that America is becoming more diverse, it's like a joke. Ha ha. People are not all identical. And the North American New World context is not simply a story of black and white, or black and white and gray. There is a lot going on, and people are people, and we'll come back to that. So I already mentioned place names. Can you think of some place names that are not American English in the United States?
Albuquerque.
Squim.
Oklahoma. Oklahoma.
Multnomah.
Wenatchee. What about Santa Fe, San Francisco, Colorado, Florida?
Yeah, I think there's seven states that have Spanish names.
Seven.
Colorado, Montana. Oregon.
No.
Oh, come on, we can fit that one in.
Yeah.
California, the hot oven?
Of course. We'll get back to that. Okay, architecture. If you ever go to Southern California or anywhere in the Southwest, you're going to see adobe. You're going to see a certain style of architecture and the missions and so on and so forth. You're with me on this, right? Okay. Food. I believe tomatoes came from the New World. Chocolate was a form of currency in the Mayan world.
Potatoes.
These are things that last and continue. Culture, language, we're going to move on. So the borderlands are a space, but they're also a way of thinking. It's a way of looking at who we are and who are we. And the things that are happening, it's not, again, I just want to say this again in case I haven't said it enough times yet. Power is not a one-way thing. It's not like power happens and everybody just flops along and is changed by it. People have agency. We have a choice in how we respond to what happens, just as we have a choice in what we do. And so the borderlands is speaking to, yes, there is domination and power and oppression and abuse of power, but that's not the whole story. And it is one of my goals to say that as many times as possible. That is not the whole story, and you can do something. What is this?
Spanish.
New Spain.
Yeah, but what do you see when you look at this map?
American states.
And part of Mexico, yeah. But what does this bring up for you?
Civil War.
Parts of the United States that were once either Spanish or
French. It's familiar. It's the lens through which we've been taught the United States exists.
Absolutely.
These are borderlands.
And we all know that the Canadian border is up there at that line most of the way, right? And we know where the states are. And like Indiana is here, right? And Michigan. Okay. All these places. Washington. Where's Washington?
Up there.
We recognize the shape of Washington, or Minnesota, or Wisconsin. So we have a way of thinking about this picture already. And it's interesting, this map does a couple things. First of all, it shows the rivers, which are... human society tends to gravitate towards water, as far as I can tell. Rivers and oceans. But the other thing that the map does so interestingly is to actually draw out the lines of states that you recognize, like Louisiana over there. And part of the whole thing that why I like this map so much is because, first of all, it includes some of the native groups and cultures on the map, but it also reinforces your idea of what the United States is. And part of what I want to say is that they just drew these lines. They created these places. So Washington State is a place, but it's also not. Okay, so one of the scholarly ideas is that this is the Spanish borderland, this whole thing. You don't think of the Spanish over here so much, even though they landed in St. Augustine in 1562. 68. This whole area was part of New Spain, and that is the Spanish Empire beyond Mexico and South America. And so much of this relies on struggles in Europe. so much of U.S. history is based on what was happening between powers in Europe. And what was happening in Europe is not always reflected on what's happening on the ground in the U.S. So you had, for example, Catherine in France and Elizabeth in England and Philip II in Spain. And what they were doing with their families and their domestic problems and their kingdoms and so forth, that had grave consequences for who had control of what. And we're going to see in a minute how changes in who's controlling what can lead to conflict in the new world, but it doesn't change the people that are already there. It doesn't change the fact that they've already started being forced to learn Spanish or learn French or learn English. And so when you think of sort of New Spain, it's also interesting the extent to which these guys really wanted gold. And it's okay for me to say these guys because they didn't consider women as part of the exploratory. Women were not explorers in Europe at this time. And so you had a bunch of crazy guys, and they were looking for gold, and they were going to find gold, and they had a vision of gold cities that, as far as I know, have never been located, but they were looking for them. And these guys walked everywhere. One journey I enjoy a lot is 600 people started off in Tampa, Florida, and they lost 300 people before they crashed their boat here. And then they went up, and terrible things happened to them. They were going to find gold. They didn't find any gold. They end up over here living on an island. They made boats out of their horses and the sails out of their clothes. And so they're wandering around in their rusty armor with mosquitoes and people shooting arrows at them. And they're dying. And out of the 600 people that started, three people survived to walk all the way over here and then all the way down to Mexico City. And that's a very interesting story because of the loss of life and the cost at which these people were willing to pay for something that they never found. But also the extent to which this was sort of normal was that when they discovered San Francisco by accident, they walked from one of the famous missions here all the way up the coast. And they were looking for Monterey. And there's a lot of these examples where people were looking for something like the Mississippi River, and they couldn't find it. So they found San Francisco by accident after having walked 1,800 miles. And there's also examples of ships having sailed around the bottom of South America from Europe. They come up and they get to the West Coast and they're too sick to get off the boat. So there's a kind of fanaticism about this, the lengths to which people were willing to go, in interest of something that, as we will see again and again, was not actually there. And when you look at the entire conflict in Europe and how that underscores the development of the Spanish borderlands in the U.S. at large, and the way that religion plays into this, I think there's like a question about human nature in here somewhere. And while we're talking about religion briefly, it's important to recognize that the French were in Florida along with the Spanish, and they went back and forth taking missions and forts back and forth from each other. And because the French settlers and missionaries in that part of the world were Huguenots, which is Protestants, and in this case, these Protestants were Lutherans, there was a great deal of animosity between the Lutherans and the Catholics. And when the Spanish retook their fort in, it's up towards South Carolina, they demanded everyone surrender. The French surrendered. They said, if you pay us, we won't kill you. The French paid them, and then they killed them. And they publicized that this was partly because they were Lutherans. And then the Queen Catherine could not strike back at Spain because Philip II was more powerful and she was also a Catholic, is my understanding. And so, once again, we see the geo-religio-politics in Europe acting on one level while people over here are dying and killing each other and taking everything that they can find. So, there's a lot going on. I want to say another thing about Spain. They sent out explorers all the way to Alaska. But because Spain had a kind of paranoid approach to its information, they would make maps, but then they wouldn't publish them. So Spain discovered things a number of times. And other people would then discover them, but the British and the Netherlands kept better maps. So the fact that Spain was the first in some of these places for Europeans didn't help them in the long run, because they never published their maps. So this adds to my sense that they didn't really know where they were. And another thing that you've probably heard about is the Northwest Passage. And the Spanish called it the Strait of Anian. And they were looking for the Northwest Passage, along with these cities of gold. And they didn't find it, ever. And I guess we found it in the last 50 years, but it's way up there and it's not of any use to anybody at this point. So in their imagination, they called it the Promised Land. They called it the New Jerusalem. This was common amongst many European powers. They thought this was the New World. And in the New World, they were going to find gold cities, and they were going to find the Northwest Passage. And if you find the Northwest Passage, you have a massive advantage in terms of reaching Asia, which, as we no doubt know, was a part of the whole impetus for this exploratory surge in Europe anyway, was trying to reach Asia. And side point, Cristobal Colón, Christopher Columbus, to the day he died, he insisted that he had reached the Indies. So it was not America yet. And he said, I didn't find anything new, I reached the Indies. So whether the world was flat or not, this says something about what people thought they were doing, what they imagined they were doing, right? And perhaps the final point on this, the Spanish often sent missionaries and founded missions, but missions did not lead to a population growth in the same way. And the missionaries were often trying to convert the natives, and they were always facing problems with the Spanish military and other lay people in the New World who would treat the Indians very badly. So the missionaries are constantly trying to keep the natives that they're working with and trying to convert and trying to civilize away from other Spaniards. So it's the entirety of a religious conquest. When half of the people that you're saying, oh, come be like us, but these people are all cheating you terribly, what are you supposed to understand is happening? Hypocrisy or something comes to mind. And it's also interesting that, obviously, there's a huge series of epidemics that cause a great deal of people to die. So on the one hand, the native religion does not protect people against these epidemics. But at the same time, after they convert to Christianity, Christianity also does not protect them from the epidemics. So it's a hard position to be in. Very good. Everyone's looking for the Northwest Passage. And also when we think about the New World, has anybody been to the Strait of Juan de Fuca? So Juan de Fuca, they say that he said he had found the Northwest Passage in 1592, and he wrote it down, supposedly. And so again, this whole thing with maps, he said, I found the Northwest Passage, but it took 200 years for anybody to find it again, even though he said it's between these two parallels. And I mentioned the thing about the Mississippi River where there was obviously a race from Europe to find the end of the Mississippi River, and even people that came down the Mississippi River couldn't find the end. So here's another picture of New Spain. And this is not so much the borderlands, this is New Spain. And so Spain is trying to control all of this land. And it's big. And Spain also's attitude towards trade was one that there were only certain places that goods could come in. So they would all land down in Mexico and have to be taken thousands of miles across land. So along with all these missions that they're founding everywhere, none of them have enough to eat. And so they're constantly relying on the goodwill of the natives that they have mistreated in many cases. So Spain began to have a problem in terms of supplying itself in this in this case. And where we're going to get to in a minute here is the conflicts in Europe are one thing, but once the colonies become an independent country, which Spain supported the colonies in the Revolutionary War, and I understand that the colonies actually adopted the peso at one point during the Revolutionary War. Once the colonies became a country independent of England, now Spain had a much bigger problem, because they're not just competing with other European powers, they're competing with a place that is growing on its own, and people are leaving that area, going west, and believing in manifest destiny, and they're going to claim the world for themselves. And so at the point at which New England, the colonies had a greater population than New Spain and a greater economic output, that's when the power shifts in this story.
So did Spain not have any colonies like England did?
Well, this is their colony.
But I mean in terms of populating and people...
Well, so Mexico was a lot of silver mines, lots of value here, lots of value in South America. They didn't find, was not finding any gold. It was not economically booming for them. And so that's kind of the thing. They're this far-flung thing that's not expanding the same way. And when you have the colonies that are already settled, people are living there, people are there to be there, that leads to a greater... I mean, they're not traveling across the ocean.
Does Villanato mean possession of the crown?
Yes.
When did France get a great portion of that territory? Because, you know, we have the Louisiana Purchase, and so what did Spain give up to France in order to get that?
Well, we're going to come to that in a minute.
We'll come to it now. Okay.
So, excellent question. So, Spain took Louisiana from France due to domestic troubles in France in 1762, I believe it is. And so Spain took control over New Madrid, took control over Louisiana. And then in 1800, Spain was having domestic troubles at this point. Napoleon bought it back from Spain, and the agreement was that Napoleon was not going to sell Louisiana to anybody else. I got ahead of myself slightly. When Spain took over Louisiana, so that was an action in Europe, and everybody understood it in Europe, but the people on the ground were French-speaking Creole people, and they were like, we don't want the Spanish here. So there was an uprising against the Spanish governor who was driven out. So the things in Europe did not necessarily reflect what's happening in the New World. So then they send actually an Irish Catholic who served in the war for Austrian succession. So there's a big connection between Irish Catholics and the Spanish military in the 1700s. And he was able to, through great show and peaceful execution of people, he chilled everybody up, and it became Spanish for 40 years before they sold it to Napoleon. Okay, so when Napoleon sold Louisiana to Thomas Jefferson in the United States, what Spain and France had recognized was something like this. And as we all know from being in the education system in this country, the Louisiana Purchase includes all of this, right? And so that's the way that we tell our history in this country. It certainly reflects part of what happened, but it leaves out a big piece of this, that this was not recognized by the people that owned the land. And I mean, I don't know why that would stop any European powers, because it's not like anybody showed a great deal of respect for what was happening on the land, whether they had land grants or not.
Well, and they didn't even respect the people in their own countries. I mean, seriously, you look at how Britain treated Scotland, and so, I mean, it's a pretty well-established historical habit of the European, that certain Europeans, not all, but certain Europeans.
And there's the whole reconquest of Spain and the driving out of the Muslims and forcing Jews to convert to Christianity. And then that's what gives rise to the Inquisition, because they're looking for Jewish people that are hiding as Christians. And it goes on. So the Louisiana Purchase was not all the way up to there, according to the people that were making the sale. We spoke briefly about the journey of Cabeza de Vaca. That's the one with 600 people that walked all the way across and ended with three. One of the people that was with him was a Moor called Estevanico. And so one of the jokes is that one of the first Europeans that the indigenous people in North America met was an African. And he became a sort of healer, medicine man, and he did a specific dance. And apparently he danced too hard and the Zunis killed him. But his sort of method of incorporating Christianity with kind of the indigenous religion became sort of famous. So it's just here it is. The first European that the people in this part of the world saw was an African.
When was this?
I forget the dates of De Vaca's trip and I didn't write it down. But after this trip where they lose 597 people in total disaster, and these people walk for 8 years,
jeez,
this leads to more searching for gold that isn't there. So it's like, oh, these guys all failed to find anything. Well, let's go launch a new mission. And that's what leads to Coronado and so on and so forth. So it's also interesting to note that as the colonies begin to expand and their manifest destiny and their claims of, we're going to civilize the wilderness, we're on the frontier. One of the famous arguments is that the frontier made people Americans. So it's not just that Americans are chosen people or this is the promised land, it's that the frontier shapes the American character. And facing the frontier is what makes the Americans. So it is in that process of living on the frontier and pushing the frontier. This is Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis. Interesting stuff, for sure. So part of the thing that's happening is the Spanish, when they came, they were just trying to convert everybody. That was part of the mission. This was about harvesting souls. This was about converting the people to Christianity. And once you convert them to Christianity, then you can make them Spaniards. The English had the opposite approach. It was, we need to make them English first, and then we will convert them to Christianity. And let's not forget that many of the English settlers were Protestants. It doesn't sound like the biggest problem in the U.S. today, but this is historically a huge problem in this country and in the world, is the divide between Protestants and Catholics, and how fast everybody is to label somebody in this way and treat them as the other. Enough about that. So here are several books on the borderlands, if you're interested. This guy, Herbert E. Bolton, he loves the Spanish. He says that he's trying to recover part of U.S. history and say, look, this is not just an east-west thing. There's a north-south thing going on as well. And he wants the Spanish to be important and valued in our society. And on one hand, he has a point. The other thing he's doing, though, is talking about how brave and wonderful and magnificent these guys were and conquering the savages and bringing civilization to the New World first. So there's an interesting line when we talk about the geopolitical borderlands, where I am trying to say that Spain and Spanish language and Spanish culture is an important part of what makes the United States what it is, without saying, look how great the Spanish were. They still were pretty bad in a lot of ways. And this is part of where we move on to the next portion of the presentation. Gloria Anzaldúa suggests borderlands refers to the geographical area that is most susceptible to la mezcla, neither fully of Mexico nor fully of the United States. You have a geopolitical space in between European powers and in between the expanding colonies, but you also have all of the people on the ground. You have people that have lived with these different languages and different cultures changing around them. And they've been there the whole time. And that is not really talked about in Herbert Bolton's Spanish Borderlands. David Weber does a much better job dealing with some of the consequences of that. And I think Daisy Machado is one of her offerings to this conversation is to say, what about the people on the ground? And that's, of course, what Anselm Dua is talking about. So this is what Daisy Machado is saying. The borderlands of Texas became home to a new and developing indigenous people called the Mestizo Tejano, who uniquely, and for the first time, combines La Sangre Española, India, y Negra. Which is why I believe in my course description I call it Amerindian, European, and Afro culture at the basis of the United States of America. And of course, we're leaving out the Philippine traders from the early 1500s and some other things with this. But this mix underlies what becomes the country.
Does she mean in here Española, India? By India, does she mean really indigenous?
Indigenous.
Okay, not
India. No. This is Indian, between Europeans
Native or indigenous.
Yes. And so specifically when we're talking about Texas, when Spain was faced with the expanding colonial, rather the United States of America as it's expanding, Spain was worried about this. And so they started importing people. They were paying people to move into the borderlands to keep a buffer. And Texas, Stephen Austin, got a land grant from Spain. Stephen Austin of Texas and Houston, these guys got land grants from Spain to settle Texas. And of course, a big problem for them was, first of all, they were not Catholic, but second of all, they were fans of slavery, and the Spanish crown, for whatever else they did not really, they had outlawed slavery at some point before.
Were Houston Austin English?
Well, they were Americans, right? And so these are the people that start the Texas Revolution and the Republic of Texas. But so Texas as it is a space that is controlled by Spain, where the Anglos are getting land grants from Spain, and then when Mexico becomes independent from Spain, they go back to Mexico City and renew their land grants with Mexico. So that's how you get Austin and Houston and everything else.
You also get a lot of ex-Confederates who flee
yes.
into Texas, which has a huge effect, a profound effect on that section of the country, because they want to hold on to that Confederate lost cause mm-hmm. dream. And I'm just going to put that out there.
So another thing to think about the borderlands in this case is there's not anybody specifically in charge, as it were. So there's more space. There's more space to do things and seek your own way and so on and so forth. So, absolutely. Texas becomes a place where you have the indigenous original folks, you have the Spanish / Mexican influence, and then you have the U.S. influence as well. And that's part of what Daisy Machado is saying, is that the culture in Texas is all of that. So it's hybridity. And so that's what this bottom sentence says, is the natives live on the land, and then the Spanish come, and it becomes a Spanish colony. But then when Mexico becomes independent, it becomes a Mexican territory. And then it becomes the Republic of Texas, and then it becomes part of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they often tell you in Texas that it was ruled by the Russians for a brief period. And that's something else that we don't talk about in our history books very much, is the Russians were a player on the West Coast.
Alaska.
Especially in Alaska.
Especially in Alaska. So, I don't know as much about that, but I know that it's... The concern by powers that were not on this continent was intense. So part of what happens when Mexico becomes a country is there's a different identity in that context. On the back of the money in Mexico, you have the pyramids. And if you go to Mexico today, you can find many temples that actually go under the road. The road goes and there's a temple underneath. And the National Cathedral is built on a temple using the rocks. And whenever they lay new electric lines, they find something under the ground. So there's a strong awareness there of there's a relationship to the bicultural aspect. And there's a remembrance that there is the culture is partly also under the ground. And that's part of what I think the difference is. It's part of what I'm trying to talk about here. I don't think in the U.S. we recognize that very often, that there is a history underneath the ground. Seattle's very interesting for its underground tour, where there was a town down there, and then they raised it up. But so part of what I'm trying to say is this idea of mestizaje, or mixing. This is from Tlatelolco in Mexico City, where Cuauhtémoc, the last emperor of the Aztecs, surrendered to Cortes. And on the site, they have this plaque, and it talks about the birth of the mestizo, the mixed race person, people. And they call it the Plaza de Tres Culturas, the Plaza of Three Cultures. So very much in the cultural awareness is the fact that there's a mixing going on. It's not a triumph or a defeat. It was the painful birth of our mixed people, which is Mexico of today. And so this is part of, as I said at the beginning, this is part of what I grew up understanding, was that it was more than just these lines and this binary. There's something else going on here. And that's part of what I'm thinking about the land and the borderlands. So, Gloria Anzaldúa, she talks a lot about language. And she says she grew up a Chicano, that's a political term for Mexican Americans generally. And Mexican Americans do not represent all of Latinos or Hispanics, but it's the closest one for me at this point. And when she's talking about this, she's saying, you know, she was beaten for speaking Spanish at school, and they try to take this language away from her. And so what are you supposed to do when, what she says, when you refer to yourself as nosotros los Chicanos, straddles the borderlands. On one side of us, we are constantly exposed to the Spanish of the Mexicans. On the other side, we hear the Anglo's incessant clamoring so that we forget our language. We call ourselves Mexican, referring to race and ancestry. Mestizo in affirming both our Indian and Spanish, but we hardly ever own our black ancestry. Chicano when referring to a politically aware people born and or raised in the U.S. Raza when referring to Chicanos. Tejanos when we are Chicanos from Texas. So when you move beyond the idea of the Spanish-American borderlands and you start talking about the people on the ground and what it means to be a borderlands person, if you grow up on a border where languages are spoken differently on both sides, with perhaps different cultures, you absorb a lot of this. And it becomes a conflict internally of who you are. And that's what she talks about at length in her piece, La Frontera, the border, the frontier, right? The barrier. And so this like hybridity of culture. One time I was working on a project and I asked people how they identified themselves. And people just, what is your identity? And people listed things like their religion and their race. One of them said they were open-minded. Somebody said they were a human being. We don't have I don't think we have a common sense of identity in this country. A lot of people now, I'm a Mexican-American, or I'm German-American, or I'm Jewish-American. And it's a funny thing. Some people say they're white. And we don't think enough about what these categories mean or how they're applied or the power involved in saying something like, I'm white. So in Anzaldúa's case, she's also talking about language, the Spanish language, and the fact that people spoke Spanish in this country for 500 years. And now we want to act like it's all one thing. Or maybe two things, but it's like seven things. I want to talk a little bit about, I want everybody to stand up. You have the scratch, remember the sky, the sun, the ground, the face of the earth, and your feet and the people that are under the ground, and the people that are in the air. And when you're all ready, we'll sit back down. Yeah, by all means. So, there's one like really good example that sums all of this up. And this is the example of Santa Fe, New Mexico. This is another interesting thing. Whenever you hear about, we're going to talk about Vargas in a minute, and I don't remember his whole name, but it's like Juan de Vargas, Ponce de León y Contreras, Luce. They have like a lot of names for everything. So the city of Santa Fe, Holy Faith, but the real name is the royal town of, the royal city of the Holy Faith of San Francisco de Assisi. And obviously there were people living where Santa Fe is before it was Santa Fe, right? So we have the New Mexico, Santa Fe is there, a dot. Yeah, that has value also, but there was something happening before they drew all of those lines. And so when Santa Fe was claimed in 1598, it was settled by the Spanish in 1610, they say it's the oldest capital city in North America. Which I don't understand. There's always the oldest something. But they say it, so. For 70 years, sort of ritual impact, the cultural impact, the religious impact. So the Spanish come and they make a Pueblo people. There's a Pueblo language, a Pueblo culture, but all of these are parts of what the Spanish call the Pueblo. And they don't have a shared identity. I mean, they all live there. They have some shared cosmology and culture, but there's not a unity among the indigenous people. The Spanish say, you're all the same. And they say, we're not all the same. But once this starts to play out, there's two sides to this. You're on the Spanish side or you're not. And so the Spanish create the Pueblo.
It never occurred to me before that Pueblo is a Spanish word.
And it often uses a people or town. So this is part of the process that happened with the Spanish, and it's part of the process of what's happened with the United States. We take a bunch of stuff, we clam it all together, and give it a name and say, this is what it is. And, you know, I already said this, America did not become diverse. America did not become diverse when it became America. It's not becoming diverse now. Obviously, it's helpful to have terms to describe an entire swath of people with all their differences, but really, we're not talking about one thing, which I've already said. And Europeans are diverse as well. Okay, so with Santa Fe, this is the declaration when the Spanish took possession of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it shows some of the differences in terms of how the Spanish approached claiming land as opposed to the English. And I will just read it. I take and seize tenancy and possession, real and actual, civil and natural, one, two, and three times. One, two, and three times. One, two, and three times. And by all the times that by right I can and should at this said Rio del Norte, without accepting anything and without limitations, including the mountains, rivers, valleys, meadows, pasture, and waters, together with the native Indians in each and every one of the provinces, with civil and criminal jurisdiction, power of life and death over high and low, from the leaves of the trees in the forest to the stones and the sands of the river, and from the stones and sands of the river to the leaves in the forests.
Clearly insane.
Well, and this is not uncommon for their letters between and their declarations, it's they did this, they read this, they have a flag with the Virgin and the King on both sides, and they say a mass, and they kiss the ground, and they ask people to convert, and this whole process, and then they read something else, and they were acting something out. And what I think is interesting about this is the way that religion is connected and the way that they claim entire domination over everything. It's not just, oh, we own this, it's we own everything above it and everything that will ever be above it for all time, and now it's New Spain.
Such humility.
And that's, as I said, Bolton, he really thinks the Spanish were fantastic. But you have to also wonder, it's like walking from Mexico City to San Francisco, like, it's a bit of a commitment. And sailing around the Horn of South America, I guess it's not the Horn, and being so sick you can't land it, continuing to look for gold that isn't there. Something's going on. And I am convinced that the Spaniards, they were not where they thought they were. Right? They did a lot of things. They left a lot of architecture and language and culture. They were looking for stuff that wasn't here. And like maybe somebody could have told them, look, you're not going to find these things, but they just kept going all the way to Alaska. So this reveals the kind of attitude that they had. And again, the Spanish, they didn't try to civilize people first and then Christianize them. The first thing was make them Christian, and then they'll come around culturally and so forth. And that is different with the English and with the colonies, when they cease to be colonies and so on and so forth. Okay, so Santa Fe, okay, so this is sort of the timeline of New Mexico. And every year Santa Fe has a fiesta, a festival, that celebrates this. And it started, I believe, in 1712 as a celebration of the ritual reconquest. So in 1680, the Pueblos, who have been created in this moment, revolted and drove the Spanish out. In 1692, the Spanish return, and it was kind of the same thing. They read this whole thing and said, you know, give up now or we'll kill you all, but you have a choice to come with us. And so they frame it as this very friendly attitude. And then they cut off the water. And De Vargas is his name. He, in all his journals, he talks about what a loving and gentle guy he is. He says, I lovingly and gently offered them to convert to Christianity and submit to the Spanish crown, or I would kill them all.
Is this isn't guy that was cutting off their feet for thousands of years?
That's Oñate, I think. But it's come with us or we'll kill you, but come with us. So Santa Fe has this festival every year to celebrate the city. They say it's the oldest city in America. It's the oldest continual ceremony in the United States. They're the oldest and the first, right? And so every year they celebrate this, which is, as I said, a peaceful ritual reconquest before the military reconquest.
Who is they that celebrate?
The Santa Feans. The city of Santa Fe.
People in power.
So, this is the big question in terms of the festival, and that's why I bring this up at the end of the Borderlands conversation. When you're reenacting De Vargas, he comes up to the front of the city, he reads his thing, he takes off his armor and goes in peacefully and gently and lovingly, and everything is happy. And so that's like the basis for the La Entrada, the moment of his entrance. But that's obviously not the whole story. So there's a great deal of tension over who's in the festival and who plays De Vargas and who plays the queen and all of these different questions. Are the indigenous people in the reenactment resisting the Spanish conquest? And so there's a lot of controversy. And as we say with this, Santa Fe celebrates this. There it is. Santa Fe now proudly celebrates multicultural harmony and by implication interreligious peace. And that's what the city says. This is about how multicultural we are. And there's a lot of tension, right? Because you have Anglos and tourists, you have Anglo Santa Feans, you have indigenous Santa Feans, you have Spanish-speaking Santa Feans, and what is being celebrated by this festival? And who are the heroes? And sometimes they flip it around. And the festival includes the reenactment of De Vargas' entrance. There's mass, there's liturgy, there's parades, there's candlelight processions. They burn a character called Zozobra, and a host of other events.
Who's Zozobra?
It's long and complicated, and I don't know that much about it, but they burn it, and it's important.
Wasn't it just recently that the city of Santa Fe hired an indigenous artist to do a piece of artwork in connection with this?
So that's between 2007 and 2012. The indigenous people boycotted the fiesta, and a lot of people were angry, saying you can't have an Anglo playing De Vargas and an Anglo playing the Queen. And where are the indigenous people in the story? And who is this festival for? Mm-hmm. The festival is to say how multicultural Santa Fe is, while talking about how it's the oldest city in North America and.
It's all for the tourists.
Well, and also annual celebration, right? So this is the sort of crux of what we're talking about here. You have a city called Santa Fe, New Mexico. And so this is not a city that's confused about its Spanish influence, right? The architecture, the name, all these things are there. And the indigenous people are very much part of Santa Fe. And this is a place. Now, in all of our modern context, with whatever it means, and the question is, who is being celebrated in their annual festival? And how? And that's...
So basically, who's considered a hero?
And is De Vargas, who peacefully conquers the city, the hero? And so the important piece about this being a reenactment is when you reenact something, you're summoning it up, you're ritually going through it. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just what historically happened, because De Vargas left a record, and he's loving and gentle, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's not what's happening in the fiesta. And the question is, as you reenact it, is it all the Indians fall down on their knees and say, oh, welcome? Or not, when they very much didn't. That's why the military conquest followed twice. And this is a place of 100 years of, up to then, 100 years of conflict, starvation, disease. 60% of the people died in that 100-year period. And at least it's arguable that the revolt in 1680 was sort of gestated in an underground sort of religious ceremony, the Kiwa. So the religious ceremony that the whites don't participate in or know about is the space where the indigenous people develop a culture of resistance and revolution, which we're going to talk more about tomorrow.
Could you say more about who De Vargas is? Or how he ended up being in the position he was?
Not right now. Yeah. More on that later. So, what I want to bring us home before we turn to questions, when I'm talking about the Borderlands, I think it's a framework. Okay? You're familiar with New York City?
Born there.
You were born there. And when was New York City founded? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 16...
If you can get the right center, you're doing better.
And what was its name when it was founded? New Amsterdam. So who founded New York City?
The Dutch.
And what is Broadway? It's a street. As it was explained to me, in the Netherlands, they often have a street that cuts across the city in a diagonal called the Hoogstraat. forgive my pronunciation. So when you're on Broadway, you're also on the Hoogstraat. And just the entire, I mean, the fact that the people that the Dutch bought the island from in the first place were not actually the Manhattan Indians, and all of that. And then all of the names of the different boroughs of New York, and then the fact that you have a Spanish Harlem, and a Black Harlem, and a Chinatown, and a Little Italy, and if you walk down the west side, you'll pass through a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood, followed by an Arabic neighborhood, followed by everything else that you can imagine.
What about Wall Street?
What about Wall Street?
It was a wall.
And what was the wall for?
To keep the natives out.
I believe it was to keep the British out.
I've heard that too,
but the actual point of Wall Street was to keep the English on the other side. And it's worth noting that the Netherlands didn't consider New Amsterdam a priority because they thought it was an economic backwater. And they were hoping to settle at Fort Orange, at Albany. So I was like that. They were like, oh, we're not going to invest in this. It's too backwater. Part of what I'm trying to get at here is the island of Manhattan, New York City, is actually New Amsterdam, and before that it was something else. And all of those realities are in the ground and in the memories of the people. And there's a huge change in the population of the city. And what there's been a resurgence in Catholicism in New York, largely due to Mexican immigrants. And that changes the shape of the churches there, which were primarily Irish Catholic or Italian. And now there's Spanish-speaking congregations. So all of these things are happening in New York. And so I always think of it very much as a place of the borderlands, where meaning is not static, and in a sense, anything can happen. But it's also to recognize what's under the ground, what was there before, right? It's a contested space. New York City is an example of the borderlands. Now, we talked about Santa Fe, right? Santa Fe. This is the kind of reality of North America. And it's true of Detroit, it's true of Louisiana, it's true of Milwaukee. All of these places where there's a history. Sometimes I find interesting in the Northwest, there's like more of a recognition that there were indigenous people here first, and gosh, we feel bad about that. But like, it's real. These were people. And I don't think Chief Seattle would be thrilled about what's happening in the city that's named after him, especially when the first settlement was New York Alki, which I like a lot. What I'm trying to say is that there's a history, and the way that we tell the history is important because we end up obscuring all of these people. It's not just we don't want to talk about the Spanish and how great they were. This is not just a story of heroic British Protestant white folks going across the continent and driving out the frontier before them. Because there was another history there that preceded that. And that's not even the one of the indigenous people. And it's interesting the extent to which landholders in the U.S. today hold the land based on grants that originated from the Spanish crown, which is a story for another time. Santa Fe, New Mexico. I am a borderland context. It comes from growing up in a bilingual household, where the idea that there's this line at the end of the block where on the other side is a different country. And it's not a country that... El Paso does not really take the Spanish or the Mexican-American history seriously. The Historical Society, I believe there's two Spanish surnames in the entire list of 150 years. And that's pretty strange. But there are some other borderlands contexts here, and that's you. Because everybody comes here from somewhere, and a lot of you have a different cultural background. Some Norwegian, some Danish, some German, and some from other places. And the question of how you live that tradition into the present, and how you hold that in tension with all the other things that have happened and are happening and will happen. And it's always fascinating, this is only the second time I've been here, but the fact, when you walk around here, that this was a mine, where they were tearing the earth open and hauling out rocks to make planes to drop bombs on people, or what have you, this entire place, what's that?
It's a testimony to what people will go. I said this on the bus coming up. 10 miles in, you gotta go. You gotta float up a big, huge honking lake, and it's all because you're after one metal. It's a testimony to our what you were talking about.
Right. It's we're gonna find it, right?
Yeah.
And you see it the more you walk up the hills, and you get a view of this valley, and it's, you know, we are way up here. And the reason that we're way up here is because of a mine. And I don't know enough. I mean, I read briefly this thing about Lake Chelan has been populated by human beings for 9,000 years. This is a borderlands. And they said it's also I mean, can you get farther away? And so that's what I think is so both interesting and special about the moment we have here, is that we're sitting on the ruins of something that is probably wholly destructive, and it's been revitalized to be something different. And at the same time recognizing that if you spend more remediating a mining project than actually came out of the mine in the first place, I feel like there's a lesson that might have been missed somewhere. And so it's interesting to me that both the tension and the potential and, you know, the message of it all. To be on the face of the earth under the sky in this place that was built for these things. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to look at that around this country and around the world. And so I want to say again that the borderlands for me is a framework to look at how we think about what America is and who Americans are. Christopher Columbus insisted this was not a new world. So the great hero of our October 12th, he didn't know where he was. He didn't see the potential of the exploitation that was going to come out of that. And we celebrate it. And maybe not we, but this country celebrates it. And so part of my question is, what would a ritual like the Entrada Santa Fe be if we did it of the United States? And who would be included officially? And so finally, when we talk about the borderlands, it's not so much a question of these people are, because who are these people? These people are us. And whether you benefit from all of this or suffer under it, this is our story. And so we think about this year's theme of unity of love, and it's a little bit like, how can we be more hospitable with each other while we understand, while we take responsibility for some of the things that we didn't earn and that are given to us by the unequal production of power through history. So, the borderlands is a framework to think about where we are and what it means. And now let's have some questions.
But initially, when you're talking about America, our son spent some time in Argentina, and he said that for folks who do not live in the United States, calling the United States America is really offensive.
Oh, yeah.
Because it excludes Central America and South America, and it just says that this is America. So.
Canada. And it leaves out referring to the United States as America as if there are no other Americans is, I mean, it's farcical. There's the Caribbean, there's Canada, there's Mexico, there's all of South America. It's a continent, by the way. The other thing linguistically, though, is United Statesian is unlikely to catch on.
Estados Unidos, is it what he said?
Well, Estados Unidos, right? But in English, United Statesian
right,
is not going to catch on.
Right, right.
But it is true that I've heard this argument many times. People from other countries in the Americas are like, you're not American. And that's part of what I'm trying to say here is... Or...
I was interested in what you said about sort of borderlands, not just as a place, but as a time. Because it's like you're emphasizing that over time, that's what makes the border.
Right.
I was also ignorant of, like, how does the timeline work with African people being in the borderlands?
One thing at a time. So the idea of a border, right, you can't necessarily have a borderlands without some semblance of a border, right? Because now you have something that resembles a division. And my favorite example is that of when Czechoslovakia was divided into two countries. They have regions in both of these countries, and they have cultural identities. But when they made Slovakia separate from Czech, they kind of drew a line, and it goes through people's backyards, for example. And so now your backyard is in another country. And when you think about it, is how do the Czech and Slovak people identify themselves, and how do they feel about each other? And just because they drew a line down the middle of your backyard doesn't change your relationship to the land or who you understand yourself to be. So that's part of why I think the rivers are so interesting as part of the landmass, because they provide a barrier. Mm-hmm. And as I'm going to talk about tomorrow, different areas on like a volcanic lake, you may not have much communication with people over there because you can't get there on foot. But so the borderland changes over time as through colonialism and through the way that we create nations, Yugoslavia, into all of these places, and you draw a circle around it and say, oh, now it's Kosovo. Serbia, and there's all these people that are different ethnicities, different religions, and they're all in one place, and they're like, look, we're not the same. We don't get along, or whatever you want to say. Over time, you create boundaries. Boundaries are created. And part of the question is, you can still live in that place, but how does the border change you? And that's part of the thing about my grandfather. It's on this street, like, when did they put up that fence? It wasn't there when he was growing up. And now this has changed due to the idea of the border. Now, in terms of African presence in the New World, there were more Africans taken to the Caribbean and South America by a large margin than were brought to the US. And there's a huge question around economy and technology in terms of where this was happening and how it impacted legal negotiations, as it were, over the shape of things and who had power, right? So there's a great deal of literature about this. And I'm not going to go into great length about it now, partly because of how many centuries you're talking about, starting with the Portuguese explorers in East Africa.
It seems to me that in our current world, borders are increasingly tools of othering people. They're made increasingly porous to flows of capital, but impermeable to people who need to move precisely because of those flows of capital. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, a border is increasingly a tool of oppression.
And on the one hand, I always like to ask, are you the same person after you cross a border? Probably recognizing that when you cross a border, you're under a new political economic system. And whether you're going home or you're going abroad, you're a foreigner or a native, right? And if you don't have your document, that's when the action begins. And then furthering just this aspect of, it's arguable that the U.S.-Mexico border exists as a political line, but there was never any idea about crossing over it until the 1960s in the extent that we think of it now. The sort of development of railroads, specifically down to villages in Mexico to import workers into the United States, including the Bracero program and other things like this, where they were specifically working to import workers that they could pay less to do work. And so the aspect of illegal immigration, this is a fairly new concept where it's not just about, you know, labor and money and people, it's, oh, now these people who, now they're aliens. And that's not, I mean, people have had problems with each other for a long time, but this is a concept in the U.S. is new. And, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's inherently oppressive, but it functions in a way which serves to other us all from...
Well, I think borders in some sense are a function of relationships. Mm-hmm. A good part of my ministry as a pastor was in Illinois, last 20 years in Iowa, and I recognize that because of my current relationships in the Synod in Iowa, I have closer relationships with people who are 50 miles away than those that are 15 miles away in Illinois in the church. And, you know, the Mississippi River is a division, but the Synod boundaries are a division, the state lines are a division. And it's partly my relationship with the Iowa and the state of Iowa and the people of Iowa has changed or become stronger as I've had less relationship with Illinois. And in many ways the same person, but my relationships have changed. And I think that's a function or establishing of boundaries.
And the way that the different so we say organizations have different boundaries, right? The synod doesn't necessarily correspond to the county, let's say.
Okay.
And in terms of denomination, it's not so much that you're working with the congregation that's next door, as it were. You have a certain area that you travel to, you interact with. And so that's... I like what you're saying in terms of it's the way that you picture where you are, right? It's not, I'm in Iowa, I'm in this part of Iowa, in this community, right?
Well, I think the other part of it is as I build relationships with people who were other, they're not other any longer. All right, whether it's racial or religious or geographic or whatever. So I think we need to cross boundaries through relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And then the boundaries start to disappear.
And I think that's part of the theme, as it were, of this summer is, well, I guess our spiritual leader, Ira Zepp, said, the closer you get to the center of yourself, the closer you become to everybody else. And so it's the more that we stop treating, the more that you're open to making connections and learning about other people, the less we are at odds. Ideally, perhaps, at least in my vision, that would be something we would strive towards. Because we all live here together. It's not always fun. Did you have something?
Well, we lived for 3 years up in Canada, and I used to think before I moved up here that Canadians were just Americans north of the 49th parallel. But they're not. And the thing that surprised me so much was the fact that there was a suspicion of America that was expressed to me on several occasions that I had no idea how the rest of the world or that part of Canada looked at us. Basically that we are big and we're powerful, and they're distrustful of a lot of our decisions. And the reason that was news to me is that I've lived in that context all my life, being part of America and all of that. I'd never realized what it was like to be in another place in the world and have to look at us in a different way. And I discovered so many wonderful things about living in Canada, that they have a different philosophy. The concept of the common good is alive and well there, which, when I said it in the context of a family meeting or get-together, one man jumps up and says, first words out of every socialist mouth, the common good. So, you know, it's a different way. And those, I could relate to what he was saying about being closer to people 50 miles away than those 15 right next to But I never thought of us as being, I always thought of us not as being the good guys, but I never thought of anybody being suspicious or afraid of us. Don't ask me what at all.
You know, I think it's, you're fortunate to have had that experience, because even if you know a lot and you think you know a lot, traveling is good, because you find out that either you don't, or a lot of the things that you're basing your idea, what you think you know on, is not necessarily the case. And it's, you know, I think part of the problem is we don't have enough neighbors. You know, much like the Pueblo were created, the entire idea of the United States of America is a monolithic thing, which is part of what I'm trying to say about diversity. If we celebrated our diversity in a more open and respectful and understanding way, that would give us more in common. And that's part of what I think you see in what I saw in both Europe and Central America, was people were more aware that they were living close to people that were different than them. And they didn't share necessarily the same attitudes. And so, I mean, I don't know how much human beings are inclined to distrust each other and always struggle, but there's a way to be nearby each other. And, you know, look, if you live in the United States, if you grow up in this country, you're going to be, it's in your head. They got a lens in your brain, and you're thinking about things through that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, decolonize yourself. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I think you're fortunate to have had some of that pulled back and say, hey, look, it's not all this way. And that's important to remember as well, when you get down about all the things that are happening. It's not all this way. Maybe all that you can see, but that's not all that there is. Yeah. And that's part of the thing, you know, there was something here before, and there will be something here after. And it might be the bears. And even though, oh, well, we're out of time. So everybody go have dinner and remember the borderlands.